The Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is February the 17th. We're in Juneau, Alaska, the state capital. It is 8:30. Today at the table we have Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon, Vice Chairman Dick Bishop, Senators Peter Machicki, Natasha Imhoff, Mike Dunleavy, and Senator Olson, Johnny Olson, Dr. Olson. So today we have the third department of the four major departments that are the cost drivers for the state of Alaska. And we are doing things a little bit differently, not business as usual. Normally these hearings are in subcommittee. The subcommittee chairman on the HES budget is Senator Machicki. But we're trying to get a better understanding of these four big cost drivers by the full finance committee so we can have a better understanding of the services they're providing and understand what services they provide to the people of the state of Alaska. We have we are in difficult financial times. The state of Alaska continues to face north of a $3 billion budget. The Senate has targeted 10% of that this year as its goal to try to streamline the state's budget. And I might state that this sounds like a large figure, but in essence it is a nickel on a dollar. Our governor has stated last year the budget was critical. This year we're in crisis mode. We only have 1 year's left of savings in the CBR in order to address the state's fiscal crisis. If not, we face a cliff that we will have to, by our constitution, have to live within our means, which would mean if the funds were not here today, we would have to be reducing government by $3 billion. We do not want to face that, and that is why we think that the actions that the Senate is taking, along with looking at additional revenue measures and structural changes, is the prudent thing to do. So with that, we have the Department of Health and Social Services. We have the Commissioner Val Davidson. Can you come to the table and invite anyone that you feel necessary to present the services that you provide to the state of Alaska and the corresponding budget?
Oyana, Mr. Chair, members of the Finance Committee, my name is Nukhagalak Valerie Davidson, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Here with me at the table is Shonda O'Brien, Assistant Commissioner. She is relatively new in her job, but longtime employee of the department. Also here with me today in the room is Deputy Commissioner John Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner Karen Forrest, Chief Medical Officer, who also doubles as the Director of Public Health, Dr. Jay Butler, Monique Martin, our Healthcare Policy Advisor, and our eight division directors are either available in the room or many of them are actually on the phone. Vicki Wilson, Director of the Pioneer Homes, Randall Burns, Director of the Division of Behavioral Health, Margaret Brody, the Director of the Division of Healthcare Services, Barbara Murray, the Acting Director of Juvenile Justice, Christy Lawton, the Director of the Office of Children's Services, Monica Windham, Acting Director of the Division of Public Assistance. I also already mentioned Dr. Jay Butler, who serves as Director of Public Health, as well as Dwayne Mays, the Director of Senior and Disability Services. So the Alaska Territorial Health Department was established in 1919 when Alaska was still a territory. And upon statehood in 1949, our responsibilities were expanded to provide for the protection and the promotion of public health and public welfare. And that is outlined in the Alaska Constitution at Article 7, Sections 4 and Sections 5. The following links that are included on this slide, for those of you watching online, I'm now on slide 2. The first link takes you to our department's homepage, as well as the resource links. The second link, takes you to the constitutional authority, again, Article 7, Sections 4 and 5. The third link takes you to the duties of the department, our statutory authority, which can be found in Title 47. And the fourth link is our FY18 proposed budget. We are now on slide 3, and these next 5 slides have been prepared by Legislative Finance, and Assistant Commissioner O'Brien will present the highlights of these slides, our 10-year lookbacks.
For the record, my name is Shonda O'Brien. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Health and Social Services. This first slide is a 10-year lookback of the department's overall budget for our general funds only. And from this slide, you can see we are in a decline in our UGF and our designated general funds. Starting in fiscal year 16, we started to see decreases in our overall general funds. Slide 4.
Excuse me, Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I notice a footnote that you're using a department of labor status for resident workers, and I was wondering if we deploy services to folks who are not resident workers.
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, we, as far as benefits, are you talking about benefits?
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Yes.
You've highlighted a box, thank you, Mr. Chairman, that says the department's totals in FY18 GF equals $3,414 per resident worker. So it's a footnote you called out, so I don't know why it's there. If there's a comparison, I'm trying to understand what it is.
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, the footnote was prepared by Legislative Finance, and it represents what they average out the dollars that our department is budgeted per the resident worker based on the Department of Labor's data. So it would just be those people who are considered residents in the state of Alaska.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that you're using Legislative Finance Division numbers as far as apples to apples for our conversation. Is there a reason then that you asked them to give management plan instead of actuals? Would we see something different if we saw actuals over the same period of time?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, we could provide actual data. I believe that Legislative Finance uses this format for all departments. It wasn't something that we requested that they do, but it is a good comparison of apples to apples, as you said. We would be happy to provide you with what our actual spend was, though.
That would be great. Thank you. Thank you, Senator McKinnon. Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your note also says that the annual growth between FY08 and FY18 has an average growth of 3.1%, but if you can please focus on, so our interest is how we got there on dramatically increased costs of our government, what are sort of the causal drivers of getting there. And if we take probably FY8 through 18, perhaps it's been a 3.1% average annual growth, but what happened between 2009 or 2010 and 2013 for that dramatic increase, which I haven't calculated, but obviously is not an average increase of 3.1%.
Through the chair, Senator, we have, I don't have the details of every specific area of growth for those years. Essentially, though, the majority of our growth were in our UGF dollars. Some of that growth was also in our designated general fund dollars, and our designated general funds tend to be things like the alcohol assessment fund, the vaccine fund, and things of that nature. We could get you some specific detail on what was the causal effect of all of that growth for that period of time.
Senator Michicki.
Just when we evaluate what services can remain if we continue being forced to cut, I think it's important. it's important in understanding the growth and if all of the services are necessary and constitutionally required. So I'm curious if it's possible for you to spend some time as we go through the subcommittee process as well and understanding that period of time. It's substantial.
Sure. Thank you, Senator Machicki, Senator Dunleavy, and then Senator Olson.
Thank you, through the chair. Just to follow up, I just hope I'm clear. Between that period of time, can you outline the programs that were added and maybe additions to existing programs? If you could lay that out and get that for us, that would be great. And then another question, and I'm sure this may be slightly premature, but what? how long does an individual have to be in the state of Alaska to receive any benefits through your department? Is there a residence requirement? Is it the day they land, the next day if they go to an office and sign up? How does that work?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, we could get you some specific detail on the eligibility requirements for our programs if you'd like. I don't know off the top of my head what the requirements are as far as duration of residency before you're eligible for a benefit. So I wouldn't want to answer prematurely.
If you can get that, that would be very important because there is a dialogue occurring as to when somebody steps foot in Alaska, when are they eligible, when can they go and get those benefits. Please do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you know, that a number of years ago when the administration first came on, Medicaid expansion was one of the issues that was I wouldn't say controversial necessarily, but was certainly bantered around a bit. As you look at these graphs and bars that are here, since we're looking at the finances and the finance committee, how would, I'm assuming this includes the Medicaid expansion numbers that are there, what would it look like if we didn't have Medicaid expansion?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, we do have some specific information in future slides about how we've gotten to the Medicaid expansion numbers and what those numbers would look like. Essentially, this is just our general fund spending. In some future slides, you'll see where the total funds compare to the overall general funds. And for Medicaid expansion specifically, you'll see increases in our federal authorization while our general funds have been declining. So overall, we've been increasing the Medicaid program costs but decreasing the general fund dollar spend.
Last question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Olson.
Has to do with when was the essentially the senior payments and the Medicaid dental services reinstituted here in Alaska, and what effect has that had on this chart?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I would have to follow up with you on what year that actually came into effect, unless.
Brief at ease.
My real question.
Commissioner?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, the dental benefit was re-added back to the our Medicaid program in about 1998, but we can provide you with more detail about what that meant in terms of budget implication.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No further questions.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Mr. Bryan?
So as I was mentioning before, some of these other slides will kind of break out the overall budget for the past 10 years. In some different categorical areas. This one gives you a picture of how our funding is broken out across all of the line items in the budget. The majority of our budget is in the grants and benefits line, with the emphasis being mostly on the benefits themselves that go out to the recipients. And from here you can see that we have had growth in our grants and benefits line items. On slide 5, we're looking at the department's budget broken out by all of the divisions within the department. And these represent our general fund dollars only by division. The next slide will show you how that compares to the overall funding by division. From this chart, you can see that the largest expenditure or funding authority in the department is in our Medicaid services component at the very top. And so as far as the general fund dollars go, we have seen a decline in the overall general funds in the Medicaid services component. The other lines listed below are the rest of the divisions within the department, and most of the funding is really hard to see much of the change because the dollar amounts are so low in comparison.
Senator Machicki?
If you can go back one slide, pretty important. Slide 3 shows that curve or that increase from FY10 through 13. Similar on the next slide, 4, different scale, but same fairly dramatic increase. And then slide 5, I think, clearly demonstrates the primary cost driver in that increase. So that's going to be something that we're very interested in focusing on, how we got there and specifically what services we've offered that have driven that increase. And here it says that the it's overall up $300 million at 36%, but Medicaid is up $145 million, 33%. And I assume that's over that same span, but there are pieces of this where the increases were dramatically higher than 33% in smaller chunks. So obviously it's going to be a focus area. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't need to spend any more time on that.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Mrs. Bryan?
So one thing to note here in this slide is that there's a significant dip in FY10, and that was when the department received funding through ERA, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And so one of those drivers of cost increases after that was the replacement of that funding with UGF dollars in the Medicaid program. Another cost driver for the Medicaid services program is also there's an increase in enrollment and utilization in the program over those years. So one of the things we can provide to you is kind of, you know, how that enrollment has increased over time and some of that information as far as the past 10 years go. So as I mentioned on slide 6, this is just the same information broken out by all the funding sources within the department. Again, Medicaid services is the largest contributor to our budget. One thing that is important, I think, to note, again, is that while our benefits and our services have gone up in Medicaid, we have seen a decrease overall in the UGF spending since FY15 of over $100 million. And so this increase really is largely federal dollars.
Senator Dunleavy.
Very good. Through the chair, is that a result of just cost shifting, though, shifting your costs from UGF to federal money?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, it is largely, a lot of it is with reform initiatives and cost shifting, as you said, from federal dollars or from UGF to federal dollars. But there's also been program growth, too, included in that.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator McKinnon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a follow-up to Senator Dunleavy, when we accept the federal funds, do we accept a condition to advertise those benefits out to the general population?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, no.
Mr. Chairman, just a personal experience. I happened to enjoy a movie in the last 10 days, and I saw the daycare assistance program being advertised on the screen. That's why I'm asking. So we're taking funds and we're advertising that we have services available to spend, and I'm wondering what's prompting that advertising to draw people in to receive benefits.
Commissioner?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, The child care benefit is really a benefit that is provided to states to be able to get folks to support them in their work so that they can have jobs. Unfortunately, with the rising cost of child care, most folks who are entering into the labor market don't have sufficient resources to be able to pay for the full cost of daycare. And so the child care assistance program really helps to subsidize the cost of that child care so that that person can continue to work.
Senator McKinnon.
And the question begs itself, is it required to advertise the benefit?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, there isn't a requirement by the federal, our federal counterpart agency for the child care benefit program for us to advertise for those services. There are some services offered through the child care program with our grantee agencies, and so I'm guessing that that may be part of the resource and referral program with one of our grantees to do some outreach efforts or something of that nature.
Senator McKinnon.
So the state is requiring a grantee to advertise the benefits.
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, I don't believe that we require them to, but I believe as part of their program, that's within their purview to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator McKinnon. Senator Machicki.
I just thought it was important to clarify. Senator Dunleavy talked about the cost shifting, but the reality of it is it's proportional to increase in general fund costs as well. It's close to a one-to-one. So although the federal investment has increased, the general fund trend has followed very closely. I don't know if I'd define that as a cost shift. It's an increase across the board.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, if you look at the 10-year period, the 10-year look-back period between 2008 and 2018, yes, that is true. If you look at the most recent time period between fiscal year 15 to fiscal year 18, we have been fairly aggressive in terms of refinancing our Medicaid program to be able to seek more federal dollars that will allow us to also save general fund dollars. Some of those, a big provision of that was included in Senate Bill 74, the Medicaid reform bill for the tribal claiming piece, which we're prepared to speak to later in the slide presentation.
Senator Machicki.
I think that's fair, and you deserve credit for that. The trends in the last 3 years have been down on state spending and up on federal spending. But I do look at a 10-year horizon because, again, whatever optional and other services we agreed to bring into our portfolio of support, I think has something to do with what got us there in the first place. So that's the only reason I bring the longer time span into it. But you do deserve credit for the last several years. You have been aggressive. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So through the chair. There are many factors that affect the increases of health care, and I know that it's hard to isolate it and study each one, but just in your opinion, just kind of in the last decade, in the increases of costs, can you comment about what has been due to increased utilization, increased population, or increased just the inflation of health care costs?
Through the chair, Representative Von Imhoff, a number of factors, and if you look just beyond, well, let me stick to Medicaid for a minute before I sort of transition into Alaska healthcare market at large. With regard to the Medicaid population, over the last several years, we have seen a decline in our economy, and so more people are eligible for Medicaid and more people are signing up. Unfortunately, as we are taking budget cuts in our department, just like every other department in our state, we are also in the position of being the place that people come to for assistance when they lose their job or they experience hard financial times. Largely that's through the Division of Public Assistance, through various programs, and also through the Medicaid program. If you look at what's happening statewide, we certainly recognize that health care costs have been increasing. Alaska certainly is not exempt from the trend that is happening nationally. I think one of the challenges we have is, as Alaska has a large state, large geography, but a small population. So in terms of the cost drivers for Medicaid, some of those cost drivers are simply access to care issues. So if you're a person who is in, I'll use me as an example, let's pretend that I'm a Medicaid beneficiary, and if I'm in Bethel and I have a heart attack, I would need, they're not able to, there's no cardiologist in Bethel, certainly not if I lived in a smaller village like my mother's home village of Guiginoc. I would need to be medevaced out of that community to the next location that has a cardiologist, probably to the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage, or perhaps to Providence or Alaska Regional. And that emergency medical travel is covered by Medicaid. So one of the things that is helpful for Alaska is in many parts of the state that are beyond what I think the United, what my mother still calls folks in the United States of America call rural, to us is really frontier. But in many of our frontier communities, where the largest cost of that access to care, that travel or that medevac occurs, a lot of that travel, in fact, the majority of that travel, almost exclusively all of that travel, is travel that can be covered at 100% federal match for emergency medical travel. Because when three things come together, if you have an IHS beneficiary, Alaska Native or American Indian like me or like Shonda, who is also a Medicaid beneficiary, and they receive their care through an IHS facility, Indian Health Service facility, which includes tribally operated facilities, then rather than when the federal government reimburses the state for their federal match or their federal medical assistance percentage, rather than that being reimbursed at 50%, it's at or a little bit higher percentage, then that is reimbursed to the state at 100% federal match. So that's the kind of refinancing effort that we were talking about before. And maybe I'll get into more of this a little bit later, but travel and access to care is always going to be a cost driver for us in Alaska, simply because we don't have roads connecting most of our communities.
Senator Von Imhoff. Thank you. Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, back to the daycare assistance. Is that a federally funded program, and does it require a state match?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, yes, it is a federally funded program. There is a small percentage of match for pieces of the funding that are received through that program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator McKinnon. Mr. Bryant.
Slide 7. This is just a nice way of presenting how our funding breaks out across all the different categories. And so, again, as I had mentioned earlier, that top bar is our federal funding, and you'll see that as our overall costs have increased, our federal funding has also increased. The general funds have been going down. That's the blue shaded area. And then our other sources of funding have kind of remained at the same levels. There's some reductions, but not significant to make a notable visual.
The next 12 slides include 99 rows and 12 columns of detail. You'll be happy to know that we're not planning to go row by row, but we did want to. This matrix was presented, was prepared at the request of the other body, and is a helpful way to be able to look at the department's the detail of some of the department's budget. So, if I may, column one, we numbered to make it easier to track the 99 lines of detail. Column two is the allocation or program name. Column three is the total funding, the UGF funding, the designated general fund funding, federal funding, and other. Column 4 is the number of employees in that unit. Column 5 is the number of Alaskans served. Column 6 is the percent of the cost of that program recovered through fees. Column 7 is the rating of importance to mission using criteria provided by that committee. A rating of critical is directly accomplishing the department's constitutional or statutory mission statement. A rating of important may not directly relate to core services, but perhaps provides indirect supports and services that would need to be reassigned if that program did not exist. A rating of beneficial is enhances and supports the core service or provides beneficial and efficient services to a wide range of Alaskans, but could not be removed without direct impact to the core service. And status quo means that it has been historically funded or has been funded because of a statutory requirement, but have no real effect on core services or potentially hampers agency funding. Quite a number of tongue twisters in there. Column 8 is a rating of effectiveness, and we used a scale of 1 to 3. A rating of 1 is that we're getting the job done. A rating of 2 is we're getting the job done, but we see substantial opportunity for improvement. A rating of 3 is we're not getting the job done, and we see limited opportunity for improvement. And the last three columns on the right-hand side, columns 9 through 11, outline the constitutional requirement as well as if it's federally required, and any statutory authority you can see is cited on the far right-hand side. The gray horizontal rows are summaries, so not all of the information is filled in because the detail can be found in the other columns. So as an example, in row 1, the Department of Health and Social Services, department-wide, if you go to column 3, total funding is $2.7 billion. A little bit over $1 billion is in UGF. $97 million is in DGF. A little over almost $1.5 billion is in federal funding, and $101 million is in other funding. Total number of employees for the department, 3,492. We serve all Alaskans. 2.64% of the cost of the entire department is covered through fees. The constitutional requirements are found in Article 7, Section 4, and Article 7, Title 5. And then in the far right-hand side, our statutory authority can be found in Title 44 of the Alaska Statute.
Are there any ratings in the 3 category?
Mr. Chair, there are no ratings in the 3 category in this fiscal 18 budget. We really considered that to be kind of low-hanging fruit, and quite frankly, the low-hanging fruit in the Department of Health and Social Services has really been picked and eaten.
And the services to our seniors in the Alaska Pioneers Home, those are state-operated facilities, but for many in rural Alaska, they've been getting their services provided by nonprofits, primarily health corporations, regional health corporations. Are other states privatizing the Pioneer Homes, and has the state looked at that as an avenue where there could be some cost savings?
Mr. Chair, you are correct that many of the assisted living facilities in much of the parts of the states in rural Alaska are provided by tribal health organizations, which allows us to be able to take advantage of that 100% federal match. So it's in the state's best interest every time that happens for the IHS beneficiaries who are residents there. In terms of the Pioneer Homes, this model really doesn't exist in other states. There really are no other state assisted living homes or skilled nursing home facilities of this kind. There are some states that do have some veterans nursing homes that might be similar. As we, in terms of privatization, there was in the privatization, I'm sorry, in Senate Bill 74, there was a requirement for us to do a privatization study. I think originally it was a privatization study of all of the Pioneer homes. That was scaled back in final passage of the bill to look at privatization of the pharmaceutical services in the Pioneer homes. We put that out to bid, put an RFP out once. We did not have a responsive bidder. We put another proposal out. We changed some things and, again, did not have a responsive a bidder to that request for proposals.
Senator Michiki, and then Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just, looking at your, we're kind of focusing on constitutionally required services. I think there's a perhaps a local definition, depending on where your heart or focus area may be. You're quoting Article 7.4 and Article 7.5. They are incredibly general statements in our Constitution and don't define a level of service or specifics. So I think some of your yeses, it's part of what we're going to have to reevaluate. And knowing you, Commissioner, I know we share similar concerns with providing care and services for the people of Alaska. It's just we may have to rescrub the constitutional requirement definition that your department has in some cases. And I think you know what I mean. You see all of it as being constitutionally required, or very much of the services you provide. And this book is a thin book, and it's very general in nature. So I think that column is something we'll be talking about over the next, or two meetings a week, over the next 6 weeks or so to help define those requirements.
Thank you, Senator Michiki. Senator Von Imhoff.
I think Senator McKinnon.
Oh, Senator McKinnon, then Senator Von Imhoff, then Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, under your DGF, can you give us an example of the millions of dollars that are coming in to support the department under DGF? And if you could do it in the largest component, sort of backwards, so I can understand the magnitude of where that money's coming from.
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, the largest amounts of our designated general funds are in the Pioneer Home, or not, sorry, I'm sorry, the public health divisions. Public assistance also has general fund, or designated general funds. The types of things that fit into that category are the PFD Hold Harmless funding, the tobacco education cessation funding, the alcohol funds or the recidivism funds, our vaccine assessment funds, and general fund program receipt authority.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have waivers in the department that you extend benefits past the statutory requirements or the minimum levels?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, we do have one program that I'm aware of that has an exemption allowance for people to receive benefits beyond what they would be eligible for otherwise, and that would be with the TANF program or the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program. Typically, those kinds of exemptions are evaluated on a case-by-case basis by the division, and the number of people who are included in that category are pretty minimal in comparison to the overall service population.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you give us a percentage, or can you give me any more information? I don't want to get down to a granular level to expose anybody, but is it the same small group of people? And when we say small, that's all relative, right? So small could be $100 million in your budget. depending on how you're looking at that. What is small in number of families that are receiving extended benefits, and then do we have habitual families that are staying on it for a longer period of times, or are we trying to transition them to somewhere else as the program was intended to do?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, the last number I recall seeing of actual individuals or families was around 168 people. As far as a dollar figure, we would probably have to get back to you on an average of what that would be. Usually the extenuating circumstances surrounding a person being on benefits longer than the 60 months that the program allows have to do with significant barriers to work, and we have a specific focus in the in that division for people to work with those families to try and get through some of those barriers, but we could provide you with some specific examples of what it looks like and who those people are and kind of what the general trend is as far as some of those situations that come up.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you. Last question on this topic. On the waivers for TANF, if there's 168 people on waivers, how many people are on TANF so that I get a magnitude of the difference?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, we can get you a current caseload count.
Senator McKinnon. Thank you, Senator McKinnon. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So through the chair, there's three big pressures right now that I think all departments here are facing, but your department in particular. As you know, we have a budget deficit. The state of Alaska has a budget deficit that we're trying to close. The U.S. federal government under the Trump administration is looking to change the Medicaid funding system, and I think there's been discussion about a block grant and that they would like to see a fixed sum of money, and if a state spends more money than the allocated money that they allocated block, they have to make up the difference. And then the third issue is that we had Pat Pitney in here asking for tens of millions of dollars in supplemental reappropriations for fiscal year 17. So you're adding all that up, and that's we're getting in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So my question to you is what are your thoughts about that? How are you going to manage that? What are you going to do to absorb significant loss of revenue, and how are you going to address it?
I think those questions should be directed to Commissioner Davidson.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I'm going to start at the back of that question, if you don't mind. So you're correct that the FY17 budget, the department did include, this administration did include $27 million in general fund supplemental request in FY17. And that supplemental request for FY17 represents reprocessed claims that we reprocessed through the Medicaid Management Information System, or MMIS, that was built for the state by Xerox, on the date of go live, October 1st of 2013, it didn't work. And through incredible efforts, we have made incredible improvements. Folks have worked literally night and day to make sure that we could get that system up and running to where it is today. But in order to be able to go back and do the cleanup, several things happened. One is that $27 million in claims represent the reprocessed claims in prior years when the MMIS system wasn't working. And quite frankly, the only reason those claims are able to be reprocessed is because the system is now working. Certification, we've often been asked about certification and when are we certified, if not why, and when will that happen. Certification of the MMIS system, we had folks from CMS as well as our contractors here on site in Alaska the third week of September, so we are awaiting their determination. Alaska is not the only state that is awaiting certification of their MMIS system. I think North Dakota is also awaiting a determination from CMS. Unfortunately, with the change in the federal administration, we're kind of in this black zone, blackout period where there's a change in administration and things are moving very, very slowly. What that certification does, however, it doesn't affect our ability to pay providers. What it does impact is our ability to be able to claim an enhanced federal match from 50% to 75% for maintenance and operation of that system. A part of that is that in the budget is we also, the department, and I say we, although this happened before I was here, the department made advances to providers, recognizing that providers throughout Alaska were providing providing health care services to Medicaid beneficiaries, and we had a system that wasn't processing their claims correctly. So we wanted to make sure that, you know, people should be paid for the work that they do on our behalf, and so we made advance payments based upon an estimate of the amount that they would be entitled to claim. So we have advanced about $165.3 million advanced to providers. We have collected back $122.2 million back. We have an outstanding balance of about $43 million. That was on February 1st, so at the beginning of the month, we had an outstanding balance of $43 million. And we anticipate a 90% payback, or about $38.7 million, paid back by June 30th, or by the end of this fiscal year. So the system right now is paying about $30 million in claims a week. We no longer have any critical bugs to fix in the system. There are some that are important fixes. Sometimes when we fix something, it creates a problem somewhere else in the programming. We are no longer doing advances to providers anymore because they're getting paid through the MMIS system. With regard to your question on what's happening at the national level, someone asked me recently if I was doing a matrix of all of the changes that we could expect to see in the Medicaid program, and my response was just in the various versions of the two bills that I saw and analyzed, there would have been about 400 possibilities, and so too many possibilities for us to really get some specificity. As we have, our congressional delegation has been really great about meeting with us and asking us about what the impacts are. So in a nutshell, these are the challenges that we have. If the decision made at the national level is to go to Medicaid block grants, I will tell you that Alaska will not fare well under that system. Generally, block grants favor states that are large populations, that are relatively concentrated in a small number of population centers, where they don't need to travel from one place to another to be able to get care, where care is pretty much provided in a standard way. In each of those communities, the care is pretty much standard. It also favors states that have a relatively low cost of care, so that for us in Alaska, as I mentioned earlier, travel is a critical access to care issue, not only for Alaska, but also for a number of the western states where they may not have the specialists, the cardiologists, the oncologists, many of the other ologists in many communities, but they're located in a large metropolitan center like Anchorage. States that also don't fare well are states that are not economically stable in terms of their economy, states that continue to experience an economic downturn. For this reason, those allocations are made at the beginning of the year, and the next allocation doesn't happen until the beginning of the next year. So if you continue to decline, your economy continues to decline, that's a challenge because there is no mid-year correction and there is no mid-year add for the folks who we know will be eligible and likely to enroll. The other is that since the way that Medicaid works is it's federally authorized, state authorized, but the, we both share in the costs. And there are exceptions that are some programs that are 100% that are covered by 100% federal, for example, IHS beneficiaries that I mentioned earlier. So states like Alaska, where we have a large IHS beneficiary population, are disadvantaged under the block grant program unless there is an exception for the folks who already are captured at 100%. So I'm not sure if that was very clear.
Can I just stop you just for a moment?
Sure.
Senator Von Imhoff.
What I'd like to know is what will you do if your department is short several hundred million dollars this year?
Through the chair, Representative Von Imhoff, that's much more clear. Thank you. When those changes are made in the federal program, we will have to make necessary adjustments to our Medicaid program. We will not have a choice. We don't have, as the chairman was mentioning earlier, we have a $3 billion budget deficit. And if those changes happen at the federal level, we don't believe that we will be able to absorb those increases in costs. I don't think, so the question is a matter of timing. When are those, if that kind of change happens nationally, will that be phased in over a period of time? Will that change happen in a certain fiscal year? And until we have that level of certainty, there are too many possibilities to consider. But the short answer is we will make the necessary adjustments. We won't have a choice.
Senator Von Himmel.
Just last comment. It's not a question. I think that myself and potentially the committee would like to see what those potential changes would be. And number two, I hope that you're thinking about them now and not necessarily waiting to see what's going to happen, because we do have a budget deficit and we are facing reappropriations that we don't know whether we're going to have the funds to be able to reappropriate those. So I'm hoping you're thinking about those things now. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner. Good morning. Hey, I don't need an answer now because we're going to be spending a lot of time together, as Senator Machicki said a little earlier. But if you could have a little bit of a detailed report on the fraud investigation unit, how they're doing, money's collected, et cetera, kind of give us a little overview of that fraud unit, and do you have enough people to complete the mission? Thank you.
Thank you. We have a fixed time frame here. We have approximately 1 hour left. So, Commissioner?
Brianna, Mr. Chair, we'll start zipping through these slides. For each of these slides, we're going to start, we're still on slide 8, but we'll start going a little bit faster. The Pioneer Alaska Pioneer Homes, which is at row 2, 3, and 4. I'm going to ask Assistant Commissioner O'Brien to walk us through some of the highlights.
Again, for the record, this is Shonda O'Brien. So for the Alaska Pioneer Homes, we thought we would just highlight for you as we go through some of these pages some of the significant areas where we either have a significant amount of UGF funding or where the majority of our staffing is in each of these budgets. So for the Pioneer Home, the Pioneer Home makes up 2.3% of the overall budget of the department, and the majority of our staffing in this division is providing direct services, so they're working directly in the homes with the residents there. This next page, 9, is our Behavioral Health Division. In this division, it makes up 4.9% of our overall budget. Row 5 is the division's total funding. It also includes the total number of employees. In row 11, you'll see the API division, or the API component, has the majority of our staffing, and these are folks who are providing direct services to the patients in the hospital. Row 6 is our treatment and recovery grants components. This is where we have the largest amount of UGF in this division. Funding here is primarily for grant services, for substance use and prevention and treatment. This is also a component where we've seen reductions resulting from efforts of the SB 74 initiatives. So we've seen a reduction overall in the past three fiscal years to include FY18 of over $10 million in UGF. Slide number 10 is the Office of Children's Services. The Office of Children's Services makes up 5.6 of the overall budget of the department. Row 15 is the division's total budget. The majority of the staffing for the Office of Children's Services is in the frontline social worker component, which is on row 18. Rows 20 through 23 are the foster care, adoption, and guardianship payments. These are our formula programs in the division. And these are the direct benefits going out to folks who are caring for children in custody or for those children who have been adopted. Slide 11 is the healthcare services division. Row 24 is the division's total. Healthcare services makes up 0.8% of the overall budget of the department. This division is responsible for the payment processing of all of our Medicaid services payments. The staff in this component, or in this division, are those folks who are working day in and day out to get the system operating, to get payments made. They're directly involved in the Medicaid redesign work, and a lot of the different efforts that go on with the initiatives that we have going with SB 74. Row 25 is our catastrophic coverage program, and in this component we have reduced the overall budget by $1.3 million over the last three fiscal years due to Medicaid expansion.
These programs have percentage of fees. When was the last time, or how often do you review the fees that are charged by the department for the different programs?
Mr. Chair, the most recent fees have been reviewed in the past year for the Pioneer Homes. They just had a rate increase. And then also with public health nursing, they've been reviewing their fee structure. As far as a regular schedule goes, it's something that I know that the department has been really looking at, especially due to the financial crisis that we're in.
If I may add more to that, Mr. Chair, we're also considering where we may increase fees, but they may save our department money but cost another department money, and we've chosen not to implement those fees. So, for example, I think our biggest customer for public health labs is the Department of Corrections. And while we could increase a fee to be able to recover more for our department, we would merely be increasing the expense for the Department of Corrections. So we're not actually saving additional state resources. So in those instances, we have chosen not to to implement those fees.
Where if you increase the fees for lab services, you have to weigh what percentage of those lab fees are being applied to the Department of Corrections, which could still, in the long run, although a portion of those lab fees would be passed on to the Department of Corrections, the rest of the lab fees that are not provided to the Department of Corrections would be an increase. So I think that those type of decisions need to be scrutinized quite carefully to see what the net result is to the state and not necessarily just to the Department of Corrections.
Mr. Chair, we've actually done that, and we have made those fee increases where we were able to demonstrate that.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two things. You indicated that there was a cost saving for Medicaid expansion, but you haven't told us where there was a cost driver. So if you're going to share how we've saved money, I still haven't heard where we've increased costs. So I'd like to hear that. And then on the follow-up to the chairman's question on the Pioneer Home and the rate increase, can you tell us the magnitude, either, well, both percentage-wise and dollar-wise, as it is for the Pioneer Home, so we understand the implications of the task that you've done?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, the rate increase amounts, as far as the dollar figure, we'll have to get back to you on the exact dollar figure. I believe the rate increase for the current year was 1.3%, but we can get you the specific amounts and what those rate increases were for each of those years. I believe there were 2 years that we did rate increases, one in FY17 and one proposed for FY18.
And do you know what the delinquency rate is on the many of the fees for the Pioneer Homes are?
Mr. Chair, we can get you some information on who's, if you're asking who's not current on their payments,
right.
We can get that for you.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. Slide 11 is the, we are on slide 12. Our Division of Juvenile Justice, row 30 is the division's total budget. Juvenile justice makes up 2.1% of the overall budget. Rows 31 through 39 are where the employees are in this division. These employees are providing direct services in our detention facilities and our probation offices. We have highlighted on here the two facilities that have either closed or will be closing. In FY17, the Ketchikan facility closed, and we are proposing to close the Nome Youth facility in FY18.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm having a hard time reading the...
You're not the only one.
the information that we have in front of us. It appears that we have about 456 employees servicing about 1,200 youth. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, yes, that is accurate. And these are point-in-time numbers of youth. So at the point in time that this was prepared, these were, I believe, the number of unduplicated youth that were served in fiscal year 16.
And if I might, Mr. Chairman, follow
Senator
up.
Senator McKinnon.
Is this... comparable to what other states are doing at $56 million for 456 employees to service 1,200? Are those ratios good numbers? Are they high? Are they low?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, based on the recent feasibility report we received, these numbers are, they represent what would be necessary at the minimum levels, necessary staffing for each of the facilities.
As compared to the other states?
I would have to check to see who all was evaluated in that report, but I believe, yes, it was a comparison of other states.
Senator McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That wasn't exactly the question. The question was not the number of employees to student ratio or to youth. The number was the cost associated with the employees to provide that service. If best practice is 456 people to manage a population that fluctuates but is presented today at 1,200, is the cost similar? That I was trying to get to the cost. Thank you.
And I think we can provide you with more information that was produced as a part of that report in relation to cost.
Senator McKinnon? Please proceed.
Slides 13 and 14 are the Division of Public Assistance. Row 43 is the division's total budget. Public assistance makes up 11.2% of the overall budget. The majority of the staff in this division are in field services, and these are the staff who are doing the eligibility determinations and case management activities for the recipients receiving benefits. The Adult Public Assistance Program is the largest UGF in the division, and the expenditures for the Adult Public Assistance Program are used to satisfy the state's maintenance of effort requirement for Medicaid. Slides 15 and 16 are the Division of Public Health. Row 58 is the division's total budget. Public health makes up 4.3% of the overall budget. Row 60 is our public health nursing component, and this is where the majority of the staffing are in this division. Row 70 is the community health grants. These grants were recently reduced in the division's budget. The UGF funding was decremented as a result of SB 74 refinancing efforts. That program is now 100% federally funded in most cases. Slide 17 is the Division of Senior and Disability Services. Row 71 is the division's total budget. Senior and Disability Services makes up 2.5% of the division of the overall budget of the department. As with the Division of Behavioral Health, the Medicaid services are not represented in this division's budget. They're represented in the Medicaid services component. So this division's overall budget is for the administration of their programs. Row 73 shows you where the majority of their staffing is. And again, the title of the component is their administrative component. However, these are staff that really are providing direct program-related services in the division, such as their protective health services, medical assistance administrators, and things of that nature. And then slide 18 is the department support services component. Row 80 is the division's total budget. Department support services makes up 1.7% of the overall budget. The majority of the staffing in this component are the IT services. These are staff that are working directly with each of the divisions to keep their systems running and operating for the various systems that they have to manage their programs.
What percentage of this component is located here in Juneau?
Mr. Chair, the majority of the staffing for this component are located here in Juneau. A small percentage of staff are in outliers.
90%?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman.
This.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On line 82, can you talk to us a little bit about what 12 public affairs? I think it says public affairs. Can you tell me what 12 public affairs employees do for a cost of $1.7 million per year?
Through the chair, yes. So our public affairs group is really a lot of our public information team is here. We have a staffing unit that does a lot of work with public health in some of the outbreak and some of the media contacts and things like that. So this group of people are really working more directly with some of the program-related requirements that come through media contact and communications.
Mr. Chair, if I may add more to that, through the chair, Senator Machiki, we really do a lot of our advertising production for health prevention and wellness activity within this unit. So, for example, when marijuana became legal in Alaska, we were quite concerned that the only information that young people were hearing, that kids were hearing about pot, is that, yay, pot's legal. Not the best public health message we want to be out there. And so we used our internal public information team to be able to develop a cartoon. You may have seen it, Facebook and TV, ads that were really giving information to the public about about really the public health message of what happens with legalizing marijuana, making sure that kids knew that it was dangerous for a developing brain, et cetera, et cetera. And so when things like that happen, we do our best to produce things in-house so that we can make sure that the public has the other part of the important message that it, you know, these are things that we should be aware of. Also making sure that people know they can't, you know, light up on the street and they can't be impaired while they drive, etc. I got some interesting phone calls and interesting emails from concerned Alaskans who thought I was really downing their high, but you know, in the interest of public health, we think we have a duty to protect children and Alaskans.
Senator McKinnon.
As a follow-up, are we using the smoke cessation money for secondhand smoke issues related to marijuana?
Through the chair, Senator McKinnon, at the moment, no. The tobacco funds, the marijuana tax funds have not been designated to the department for use for public health messages, and so we used our existing team to be able to help to get that message out there.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, just want to make sure on a definition again at top where you see federally required and required by statute. I just want to make sure that when we go through the statutes or look at the federal, quote, requirements, that they're actually required or allowable. In other words, will it be clear to anyone that looks at it that they're absolutely required, or will there be some interpretation that maybe they're just allowable but not required? So when it says required, is that 100% they're absolutely required to have?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, let me give you an example. On line 88, Information Technology Services, it says federally required, yes. In order for us to be able to bill appropriately and to submit our reports to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which allows providers to be able to continue to bill for Medicaid as well as Medicare, we have to have certain systems in place that will allow us to be able to do that. We are also required to adhere to HIPAA standards, which protect patient confidentiality, et cetera. So that's an example of federally required.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, it's not, from what I'm hearing, is it required that you must have an information technology services 2754 at this rate with this number of people, or are you saying that there's required paperwork that needs to be done, and this is your way to make that happen?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, we are required to provide certain information and have systems that function. In order to have systems that function and meet that federal requirement, these are the employees who make that IT magic happen, for lack of a better term. I'm sure they're probably horrified at the department that I'm calling it that way, but it's, you know, it's very technical work. But in order to make sure that those systems run and that we can provide all of those protections, these employees provide that service.
Senator Dunleavy.
I think I'll leave it for now. I understand that there's a requirement to provide information. I'm just trying to understand if when it says required, this allocation through our budget in the manner that it's allocated is not necessarily the requirement. It's that is the method to underwrite what you are saying the feds, the information the feds want. I'll leave it for now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Machicki.
I'll go a little bit further with that, just because I think it's a key part of the discussion. We may need to retract if things don't improve and a sustainable budget does not get passed and that sort of thing. However you want to define a sustainable budget, we may need to retract what's required by this little blue book. I think it's fair to say that in your mind, and the mind of many of the folks in your under your charge that you might see residential child care as a constitutional requirement. It says yes on the column, page 9, the bottom box. It says yes. I don't read that in the Constitution. I read two little lines in the Constitution in 7.4 and 7.5. So if you look at the duties of the department under required by statute, and you look at some of the other requirements under statute, in your mind and heart, for those of you that deliver these services, you see that absolute requirement. But in a legal sense of the word, and if we need to retract, some of these services clearly are not defined in the Constitution and maybe outlined in statute, but often not required by statute either, right? Doesn't define the size of the department, the type of service, the depth of service. So I just want to make sure that we kind of can get to the same page. I think all of us here want to provide those things, right? We want to. We want to provide the services that needy Alaskans need to live their lives and hopefully move to a more successful place where they need less and less state services and can be successful on their own. But unfortunately, some of them we just simply cannot afford any longer just because of where we are financially, and that's going to be a tough choice. But I don't want to use this book and our statutes as, I don't want to say an excuse, but as a sort of a defining code if it's not in these books or in our statutes. Okay, is that fair? I don't want to go on forever with that, but we're going to look at those things differently. I'm going to be quite pure in how I look at them, and I think our committee will as well.
Commissioner, do you have a response?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I definitely agree that reasonable people can disagree in their analysis, and that I think that's going to happen. With regard to this particular item, though, on page 9, line 14, residential child care is an unfortunate label for this service. This isn't child care whereas and you drop your kid off and they do some babysitting for you. These are children who experience severe childhood trauma who are actually in residential treatment services. These are often involve children who are in state custody, children in need of aid cases, where they have experienced significant trauma to the point where they need behavioral health services, and they have been so traumatized that they need 24-hour residential treatment because it's not possible to keep them safe in a non-residential setting. So I recognize that the title of that one is really unfortunately named.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Machicki.
That may have been an unfortunate example that I chose on the fly, flipping through here, but I think you get my point in most categories. I mean, it unfortunately, we may need to retract to constitutionally and statutorily required services, which was my primary point.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. We have Senator Dunleavy, then Senator Bishop, and then Senator Olson.
One more. Thank you, to the chair. One more run at this. Where it says required, when we go through this, which we will, and we sit down with even potentially our legal team, will the answer be that these are compelling? They're compelled without any doubt. These are compelled by the state, the Constitution, state constitution or federal mandates? That's going to be the question. In other words, if eight lawyers sat down and looked at it, will eight lawyers say, yep, it's clear? Or will there be variation in interpretation? Because if that happens, then that particular item is called into question, and then I believe potentially goes on the reduction block. And so we're just trying to find out, it says required. Does that truly mean we are compelled by a state to offer these particular items in the manner that they are laid out, and that that compulsion is obvious to the reasonable person that reads it.
Through the chair, Senator Don Levy, this was our best analysis of where we believe that lies. With regard to eight attorneys sitting in one room agreeing, I don't think I've ever in my entire career been in a meeting in which eight attorneys were there and they all agreed on everything.
Eight average reasonable people in a room looking at something will look up and say, yes, that is clearly compelling. That's really the question you have required here. The assumption is that we got to do it. Question is, do we really have to do it, and does it really have to be done in the manner that's laid out? That, I guess, we're going to have to look at it item by item and come to that conclusion.
Niceties versus necessities. Thank you, Senator Levy. We have Senator Bishop, then Senator Olson, then we'll go around the table. The bells have rung.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your permission, I'd just like another little ask for our next meeting from the commissioner. Just real briefly, page 5, you show the increase where we received the ARRA funds, don't have to go there. My question is, when we accepted those ARRA funds, which the legislature did, everybody was pretty much lockstep on that, is there any holdover federal programs from taking those funds that we're paying for with GF today? Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, as I look at what's going on here, going back to what Senator Majiki was talking about, the Little Blue Book is not the ultimate authority that's out there. It's just a condensation of much larger thought process that went into a work product called the Constitution. And when I went to law school, you know, constitutional law was and there was somebody else at the table who's gone to law school as well. The constitutional law course was something that's complicated takes a long time to go through. As you look at what's gone on, and we all are the same way, we like things in black and white. We like yes or no. We're going to buy this or not buy this. You want ice cream or pie. But the law is not like that, and in law school we were taught that no matter what is written down in black and white, there's still everything is gray, really. And so when you look at the Constitution, that is interpreted by a number of people. But my point here is that the cost of delivering health and social services to the state of Alaska is not so much in the programs here. The cost really gets escalated if you get a plaintiff out there who feels they have not been provided those things that they think they and their lawyer thinks they are entitled to. And that's where the cost comes in, when you start having people that sue on that basis and then go ahead and appeal it to a higher court. And that's where I see us getting into trouble if we don't abide by some of the guidelines that she's talked about, that we as a legislature will be challenged. And that's where I see the expenses coming in.
Thank you. We'll go around the table. We only have a few minutes left. We'll start with Senator McKinnon. The overall issue is what level of service we will provide to the citizens of the state in light of the crisis budget situation, which has been identified by our governor and acknowledged by the vast majority of people of Alaska. No comments, Senator McKinnon. Senator Bishop, no comments. Senator Majiki.
My only comment is this subject will continue today at 11 a.m. on the subcommittee is Senators Kelly, Giesel, Coghill, thankfully Senator Olson, so we can continue our constitutional debate, and myself, Senator Majiki, and we'll be having two meetings a week. You're all invited. We hope you'll engage, and we'll get you a report for each of the meetings as we move through it. I love what your department does. Very important to all Alaskans. These are tough times, and we will be scrubbing each one of these cells of spend to see what we need to deliver going forward.
Thank you, Senator Majiki. Senator Von Imhoff. Dr. Olson.
I've already said my piece, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, just to wrap up, I appreciate the work that you folks do, and you have to advocate for your programs. I mean, this is what you do, and I understand that. And the frustration that you may be picking up is we're being told that basically from the administration, we've hit a wall, we can't reduce anymore. We had a couple days ago an AGDC report where we're giving money to the Iditarod. Don't get me wrong, we all love the Iditarod. But you can't, one cannot tell me that's a constitutional mandate to give money to the Iditarod. But we're finding these things as we're working through this, and it's leading some of us to view this whole process as almost a crime scene, that we have to be detectives to analyze this and analyze that and finally get to the point where what we're really asking for in this climate, as Senator Hoffman has said, is if we all pull together and all work together and said, you know what, this is really not mandated, and yes, this is a good program, but it's not a necessity, and yes, we could reduce this budget before we go to the people of Alaska and impose an income tax on them or take their permanent fund from them. We just want to work together with the administration. Again, it's not you folks. This is just the frustration coming out. To be able to look our constituents in the face and say, that is mandated. That is a necessity, and you know we want to help provide that for folks. But just trying to get some definitions lined out so that we have some common ground so we can move forward. But again, don't take it personally. It's just the whole budgetary process is somewhat frustrating.
And it is with that we are the appropriators. The budget is submitted to the legislature for our consideration, and what level we decide to fund is the legislature's. If the governor doesn't agree with the level, thinking it's too low, too high, he can veto it. If he thinks it's too low, I mean, too high, he can veto, line item veto it. He has very much powers in the state. If it's too low, he vetoes the budget. So that's the position that we're in. But do you have any final comments to this committee that will eventually have the final deliberation on your budget and the level of services that the people of Alaska will get?
Thank you. Oyana, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one thing I didn't get a chance to say today, but we will certainly discuss more in the subcommittee, is that based upon current projections for FY18, we will be taking administrative action to do some cost avoidance measures, including reducing rates for professional fees, hospital inpatient and outpatient. We're going to do rate freezes. We're not going to be rebasing facilities in 18. We're reducing services in a couple of areas for some codes that were added that have crept up on us, as well as reducing the amount of hours for waiver day habilitation services. And we'll provide more. We'll be happy to provide more detail in the subcommittee process. But we recognize that that we are in a budget. We are in a fiscal. We do have a significant fiscal gap. We have presented the budget in our best analysis. We recognize that not only do reasonable lawyers agree, but reasonable people disagree, and we look forward to working that out with this committee and to presenting a good program for Alaska. With that, Koyana, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we appreciate your time.
And with that, Senator McKinnon, we will not have a finance committee on Monday, but we will resume our business at this table Tuesday at 9 o'clock. With that, we are adjourned.